had 26 in the cell. And often the food is tossed in there through or under the door. And sometimes the guards count wrong, or other prisoners even take more than one before everyone gets theirs.
I spent 7 days in quarantine, which meant solitary confinement. I was supposed to get out an hour once a day, but with 26 cells all in a row, if the guards changed shifts before they got to my cell, sometimes they missed me, and I'd be in there for 36 hours straight. It was hell. Sometimes they'd have me go alone for more than a day with no food, no lounge time. Two prisoners died while I was in there.
Criminal is a short animated musical documentary featuring the musician Stu Stewart, who wrote the music with Heidi Rodewald, Krish Gundu, executive director of the Texas Jail Project, and Alec Karakatsanis, founder of the Civil Rights Corps and author of Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. You can watch Criminal on the New Yorker magazine website and YouTube channel. That does it for our show. Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh is speaking Saturday in St. Louis. You can check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and from Muertos PDX, presenting the Dia de los Muertos celebration from Saturday, November 1st through Sunday, November 2nd, starting at noon. The event features live music, vendors, children's sugar school decorating, and traditional dance performances. More information can be found on Facebook at Muertos PDX.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, National Guard troops are still kept out of Portland by a restraining order, but that could change soon.
Oregon tries to offset federal Medicaid cuts.
And a fall storm hits the metro area.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 24th, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm John Nelson. U.S. District Court Judge Karen Immergut heard arguments this morning on whether to dissolve her second temporary restraining order. In the National Guard case, she says she'll return a ruling by Monday. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned her first order barring the Oregon National Guard from being deployed to Portland, but her second order was never challenged. That was broader, having to do with National Guard from other states being brought into the city. The state of Oregon argues that order rests on different legal reasoning, so the Ninth Circuit opinion doesn't mean Immergut needs to end the order. That second restraining order is what's keeping National Guard members off Portland streets for now. Even if Immergut rules to allow the Guard members to be deployed, there's a number of other court proceedings coming up on the issue. The Ninth Circuit decision is being called into question because federal attorneys gave incorrect information about how many federal officers were sent to Portland to respond to ICE protests. In the case, they asserted 115 officers were diverted to Portland. New records show it was more like 30 at a time, taking a month-long shift. Lawyers for the state and for Portland are calling for the Ninth Circuit to scrap their order. No word on that yet. A judge in the Ninth Circuit has requested a full court review of the case, not just the three-judge panel. No vote on that yet. Next week, the trial for the facts of the case against National Guard deployment begins. That's the trial the temporary restraining orders are based out of. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield said in a statement, quote, "Regardless of how the court rules, this fight is not over. Next week, we will move to trial on the merits, where we will put on evidence proving that this deployment is unnecessary and unlawful," end quote.
The group Portland Contra las Deportaciones is hosting a rally and march on Saturday at 1 p.m., starting at Elizabeth Carruthers Park. Then, demonstrators will march to the ICE facility on Portland's South Waterfront. Holly Brown is an organizer with the group. Here's what they told KABU reporter Anna Wilcox about a rally they held early this month.
We're an immigrant rights organization that's fighting to end all deportations in Portland. And we've been really consistent at protesting in front of the ICE facility in the South Waterfront neighborhood.
So how long have you been protesting out there?
We've been protesting out there basically since Donald Trump was elected. That's when our group actually began.
You had a rally on Saturday, a planned rally, and I think about 400 people showed up, if I remember correctly. So what was this rally about? What were you trying to accomplish?
The rally was in response to Trump deploying the National Guard to Portland. So that was the main thing we were focused on, is saying that Portland does not want the National Guard and that we will not stand for the militarization of our streets. The other really important part about the protest was we specifically wanted to have it in front of the ICE facility, as Trump has stated that the reason he is sending in the National Guard is because of the protests at the ICE facility to try to shut them down. There were other politicians like Senator Merkley and our mayor, Keith Wilson, who basically, you know, gave the messaging to Portland that we should avoid protesting where federal agents would be, and, you know, really like kind of stay calm and don't take the bait was like the verbiage that they used. But we thought it was actually really important to take the fight to the ICE facility because we believe they are trying to repress our First Amendment right to free speech. And they're trying to keep us away from the facility with the deployment of the National Guard. And we're not going to stand for it because we have every right to protest outside of there. So it was really about the National Guard, but also, you know, about getting ICE out of Portland and retaining our right to continue to protest at that facility. I think that the Trump administration is doing this, and I think that ICE is doing this because the people in Portland are gaining power, and we're really pushing back against ICE in a really effective way. So we already got that land use violation served to the facility, and then 10 days after that, right, he says that he's going to send in the National Guard. So what I want to say to people is, like, what we are doing is working, and he's only doing these things because he's trying to basically silence us. So we can't allow him to do that. So I basically would be like a word of encouragement for everyone to keep coming out and to keep protesting. I know that our organization is going to keep doing protests at that ICE facility and around Portland in general. And I want to just encourage people to keep coming out. We're really stronger together. The more of us are there, the safer we are, because we know that, you know, when they attack one of us, they're attacking all of us, and we have to stand with each other.
That was Holly Brown, an organizer with the group Portland Contra las Deportaciones. They're holding a rally in March tomorrow, Saturday, starting at 1 p.m. at Elizabeth Carruthers Park.
Oregon is seeking at least $100 million for 5 years through the Rural Health Transformation Program, which was added to the H.R. 1 Big Beautiful Bill Act to improve health care in rural communities. The funding would fall short of offsetting the $5 billion in Medicaid funding the state is slated to lose over the next 5 years. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Oregon is in the process of applying for funds from the Rural Health Transformation Program, a federal program established by the Trump administration's H.R. 1 bill to improve healthcare in rural communities. Claire Pierce-Roble is with the Oregon Health Authority, which is spearheading the application process. At a recent public forum, she said whether or not Oregon receives the funding, it is still within the context of historic cuts to Medicaid from the budget bill.
The federal funding through this program is not intended to offset the H.R. 1 Medicaid cuts, and in fact, is a fairly small amount compared to the cuts that we were anticipating just in the state of Oregon alone.
The program will provide qualifying states with at least $100 million per year for 5 years, but Oregon is slated to lose about $5 billion in federal Medicaid funds over the next 5 years. The application for the Rural Health Transformation Program is due November 5th, with awards expected by the end of the year. Stephanie Jerram, also with the Oregon Health Authority, explains the funds are designed to support chronic disease prevention, technology innovations, and access to care. Though the funds will not be able to compensate for cuts to Medicaid, she says the state is taking every available opportunity to support rural communities.
The goal that we've laid out at this point for Oregon would be ensuring that all people and communities in rural Oregon can achieve optimum physical, mental, and social well-being at every stage of life.
As part of the application process, Jerram says the state collected comments from Oregonians about their priorities for supporting the state's rural health systems. She says the top priorities included workforce development, long travel distances to access care, and EMS shortages. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Oregon voters could have another shot at an open primary system. As it stands, Oregon voters can only participate in the primary for the party they are officially affiliated with. That excludes some 44% of voters who are either unaffiliated, independent, or are members of a smaller party like the Libertarians. In the past, there have been attempts to overhaul the state's election system, opening Oregon's primary elections to all voters. Last year, one effort did not make it onto the ballot. Now advocates are trying again, this time with a prominent backer. Two new initiatives recently filed would let voters consider whether to amend state law and the Constitution, opening primaries to all voters. Former Democratic Governor Ted Kulongoski is one of the chief petitioners, along with former State Representative Sherry Helt, a Republican from Bend, and Andrew Kaza, who is the co-chair of the State Independent Party of Oregon. The former governor said he has become worried the two major parties are appealing more to special interest groups and those with money, as opposed to a broader part of the electorate. He noted that the number of voters with no specific affiliation is growing year after year. Initiative 55 would amend the state constitution to eliminate partisan primaries. Then Initiative 56 would change the primary process to a ranking-style system, with all candidates listed on a single ballot. The two candidates gaining the most votes would advance to the general election. The two initiatives have been labeled the Voters' Fairness Act. To qualify for the November 2026 ballot, petitioners need to collect 156,000 signatures for Initiative 55 and 117,000 for Initiative 56 to change the state law to open up the party primaries.
Heavy rain and strong winds are forecast for the Portland metro area this weekend. Friday could see 2 inches of rain in total, which could spell flooding for some urban low-lying areas. Travel could be difficult. Wind gusts could be as high as 30 miles per hour. John Farmers with Portland General Electric. Farmer told KATU, quote, "A lot of leaves on the trees right now, and then the winds again. So that combination of a lot of precipitation and the wind again, going back to the conversation about those limbs and trees falling and taking the power lines with them," end quote. The storm is expected to bring serious snowfall to the mountain passes as well.
In national news, the federal government shutdown will impact millions of people as SNAP benefits are paused. And an FBI raid in Idaho draws civil rights scrutiny. And Congress investigates U.S. citizens being held in immigration detention. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Millions nationwide are about to miss food stamps. These are needy folks who need some help with groceries. They're not going to be able to get it. Why? Because the Democrats continue this temper tantrum.
Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley blames Democrats for the month-long shutdown's impact on veterans, farmers, and hungry families. Federal nutrition aid is now on pause in half of states, threatening the November SNAP benefits for millions. The USDA says it would need more than $8 billion to keep the program running. Virginia Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin has declared a state of emergency there. He says the state will use emergency reserves to protect SNAP benefits for almost a million people during what he calls the Democrat shutdown. Images out Thursday show the entire White House East Wing reduced to rubble as crews clear space for President Donald Trump's $300 million ballroom. Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt insists the, quote, modernization effort won't interfere with operations. Trump is backing away from plans to deploy troops to San Francisco after pushback from Mayor Daniel Lurie and tech executives. The president says he'll give the city a chance to handle crime on its own. A Virginia federal judge is ordering schools on military bases to return hundreds of books to the shelves. The ACLU attorney Emerson Sykes argued the purge of so-called woke material violated deep-rooted student First Amendment protections.
We have long had precedent that says that when this sort of censorial impulse arises, the First Amendment steps in to protect students' rights.
Titles that had been banned from Defense Department libraries included Love is Love, Sparkle Boy, and White Fragility. The ACLU is also criticizing the tactics of an FBI-led Idaho raid. Police and immigration officers stormed a family horse racing event, detaining hundreds, including children, while investigating illegal gambling. Rebecca De Leon is with the group there.
We saw quite young children, maybe 10 years old or a little younger, who were zip-tied. We have evidence of bruises on their wrists from being zip-tied, and we think that there is absolutely zero justification for that.
The FBI denies using rubber bullets on minors. Civil rights groups say the operation is feeding fear in the local Latino community. The controversy comes as federal authorities are charging 30 people, including an NBA coach and players, on mafia-linked gambling charges. A ProPublica investigation into U.S. citizens detained by immigration agents is prompting Congress to look into enforcement practices. Andrew Free with the hashtag Detention Kills Project says he found hundreds of people died in custody over the last decade and a half, with their deaths remaining hidden.
What I fear is there are people who are dying in state or local custody whose deaths are never being reported publicly. What is the true number of people dying in ICE custody? I don't actually know, and I don't think anybody does.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be rainy and stormy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow that rain continues with a daytime high of 45. Today in history, in 1946, a camera on board the V-2 No. 13 rocket takes the first photograph of Earth from outer space. The quote of the day is from British writer Horace Walpole, who wrote, quote, "The world is a comedy to those that think, a tragedy to those who feel."
A city in southeast Alaska is pausing work on a housing project after archaeologists found indigenous artifacts at the site. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The city and borough of Wrangell in southeast Alaska is pausing work at a housing project after archaeologists confirmed artifacts at the site. KSTK's Colette Zarnicki has more.
While excavating a subdivision development site on Wrangell Island, construction crews uncovered a shell midden. Middens are ancient sites made up of shells and other remains. They help tell the story of who lived there and how they lived. The borough government owns the property and is pausing work near the midden until a state-approved mitigation plan is complete. Wrangell Borough Manager Mason Villarma says development will continue carefully.
It's been a 30-year pursuit in some cases. We are, you know, into a $4 million investment, and this is an opportunity for 20 housing lots, but being cognizant of any culturally significant artifacts is top of mind.
Currently, the Office of History and Archaeology and the State Historic Preservation Office are working on a treatment plan for recovery of the site that will involve further investigation and excavation. The property has a complicated history. It was once the site of the Wrangell Institute, an Alaska Native boarding school known for punishing students for speaking their language and other abuses. Albert Reinhart, the administrator for the local tribal government, Wrangell Cooperative Association, says the site carries deep meaning.
There's a long history of colonialization that includes the Wrangell Institute, what we prefer now to call the Alaska Native Boarding School. A lot of families got separated in that time, and even my own family, there was a lot of trauma.
In August, excavators found remnants of the old boarding school, a footbridge, concrete, and utility lines. Construction was paused until the State Historic Office determined last month that the infrastructure would not be on the National Register of Historic Places. The 134-acre Aldertop Village site will eventually include 20 home lots. The public land sale auction is continuing and closes on December 1st. In Wrangell, I'm Colette Zarnicki.
A new bull riding champ was recently crowned at the Indian National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, he now has an automatic chance to go pro with the PBR, Professional Bull Riders, unlike other tribal athletes before him.
Cole Brewer has it won by 1 point. He's got a gold buckle to take home, but he is not here to take it by default.
His victory qualified the Cheyenne River Sioux from South Dakota to try out at the New York Mavericks training camp. It's a change the PBR made last year.
Our relationship with the INFR is really opening up a lot of doors for these kids.
Chris Pantani is the team's GM.
It's giving that extra shot, but those 5 days of competition are daunting. It's grueling. Five big bowls to the championship.
Past INFR champs have a presence in the PBR today. Window Rock's Cody Jesus won it in 2016.
It's a straight path to where you want to go.
And in 2023, fellow Arizona Navajo Jacoy Hale from Ganado grabbed gold. He's happy Brewer's getting a shot in the PBR.
It's a good opportunity. Wish I had that when I won it.
The Mavericks are also looking to bring back last year's champ, Tegan Gray, who is also Cheyenne River Sioux from South Dakota.
If Tegan accepts, you'll have the reigning champion coming down. You're going to have the past champion coming down, fighting for a spot on the team.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Organizers of last weekend's successful No Kings protests say they will not be deterred from future events, despite President Trump and other Republicans mocking them. And new polling suggests a majority of Americans relate favorably to the 7 million marchers who protested what they see as the U.S. moving toward an authoritarian government. Roz Brown has the details.
Targeted boycotts, electoral organizing, and additional street protests are on the table for the No Kings Alliance, the groups behind last weekend's anti-Trump demonstrations. While Republicans spent days trying to downplay the protests, an estimated 7 million people in all 50 states took to the streets, calling for an end to what they described as the administration's authoritarian actions. On a national call this week, Indivisible co-founder Ezra Levin said groups will now work to build a nationwide rapid response network, asking supporters to take new actions each week.
No successful anti-authoritarian movement in the history of the world has relied exclusively on one-day protests. Successful movements grow, they evolve, they diversify their tactics, and they do new things together.
A just-released survey from the Public Religion Research Institute shows respondents share some of the same concerns as protesters. Asked if President Trump is a potentially dangerous dictator whose power should be limited, or a strong leader who should be given necessary power, Americans chose the dictator option by 56% to 41%, a margin that has nearly doubled since April. To mock last Saturday's marchers, Trump posted an AI-generated video on social media of himself wearing a crown while piloting a fighter jet dumping feces on protesters below. Meanwhile, the federal government is shut down, and bipartisan budget talks have stalled. Lisa Gilbert with the group Public Citizen calls it the most broken budget moment in U.S. history.
Thus far, this budget battle leverage moment is being utilized by Democrats effectively to push for negotiations and an eventual deal that returns health care to regular Americans, at the very least restoring the expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits so millions more don't lose their care.
In addition to the 7 million people who participated in last weekend's events, 5 million attended the first No Kings event in June, and 3 million turned out for the hands-off event last April. I'm Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
As in many states, Michigan hospitals are scrambling to fill thousands of nursing vacancies. And in 2023, nearly 4 in 10 nurses said they were ready to leave. One group is turning its attention overseas to help close the gap. Crystal Blair reports.
The national nursing shortage is hitting Michigan hard, and one organization is expanding its search globally to help healthcare facilities fill the gap. A Michigan Health and Hospital Association survey shows about 4,700 nursing vacancies, and a 2023 University of Michigan report found nearly 4 in 10 nurses said they were planning to leave within a year. Worldwide Health Staff Solutions Chief Nursing Officer Laura Masoneo has worked in the field for 34 years. She says nursing schools, already struggling with faculty shortages, can't train replacements fast enough.
There has also been many new roles that have been developed outside of the traditional brick-and-mortar hospital settings that are drawing nurses out of the acute care setting and more so into the spa realm.
She says recent graduates may not have the critical thinking skills of more experienced nurses, and with the gap growing faster than schools can respond, more healthcare systems are recruiting overseas. As part of the international recruitment process, applicants upload their resume, take a clinical assessment, and then interview with a hiring manager. Masoneo says those applying must meet all U.S. standards.
The nurses that we're recruiting and bringing over to the United States are nurses that have passed the U.S. standard of an NCLEX exam. They also pass an English language exam of reading, writing, and comprehension. And they are BSN graduates.
The NCLEX is a standardized test required to be a nurse in the U.S. and Canada. Masoneo says nurses are recruited from 17 countries, with the Philippines, Canada, and the United Kingdom topping the list. They bring, on average, 9 to 15 years of experience across every hospital specialty. For the Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
New data show the number of critically endangered North Atlantic right whales continues to climb despite several documented entanglements in 2024. Marine scientists in Massachusetts say they are encouraged but emphasize continued protections for the species are needed. Catherine Carley has more.
Marine scientists in Massachusetts say population estimates for one of the rarest whale species on Earth continue to grow. The number of critically endangered North Atlantic right whales is now 384. That's up from 376 in 2023. Heather Pettis, a senior scientist at the New England Aquarium, says the slight increase has her feeling cautiously optimistic.
You know, it's still a really small population. It's still really vulnerable. And so, great news, but it also points to the need for continued conservation and protection efforts throughout their range.
Right whales were hunted to near extinction before landing on the endangered species list in 1970. Pettis says entanglements in fishing gear and vessel strikes remain the leading causes of serious injury and death. Lawmakers in Congress have proposed deep revisions to the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act, a landmark law credited with the recovery of several whale species. A 10-year delay of new regulations for the fishing and lobstering industry is also under review. Pettis says any changes would be devastating.
We need to continue to be moving towards more sustainable practices and thinking about ways in which we can reduce the risk of entanglement, injuries, and mortalities, and pushing those any new regulations out another 10 years is just unfathomable.
A recent report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found a dramatic increase in whale entanglements last year off the New England coast, including four right whales. Pettis says climate change is forcing right whales to shift their range as they look for food, and that scientists and the fishing industry will need to adapt practices to ensure their survival. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Solar suitcases bring safe lighting to more than 10,000 clinics across sub-Saharan Africa. The off-grid electric systems provide power for medical lights, fetal monitors, and other devices, helping more women give birth safely. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa, mothers give birth in healthcare centers that lack reliable electricity. So midwives and doctors often deliver babies in near darkness.
They're operating using kerosene lamps, they're operating with dim light, which provides a very insignificant support to be able to deliver very good health services to mothers and newborns.
Dr. Ambrose Katunji Muwezi of the nonprofit We Care Solar says without light, providers may be unable to provide safe C-sections or blood transfusions. So in difficult deliveries, women may need to move to more distant clinics, which causes life-threatening delays and is expensive.
And this ends up creating catastrophic health expenditures for their communities, affecting the overall economic status of the family.
So to help, WeCare Solar has installed off-grid solar electric systems called solar suitcases in more than 10,000 clinics across Africa and beyond. Each system uses a rooftop solar panel to provide power to a kit with medical lights, a fetal monitor, and charging ports for headlamps and other devices. So clean energy is helping mothers and babies survive and thrive. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 24, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Anna Wilcox. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Crystal Blair, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The Director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K28 2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm John Nelson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counter.